Goodbye, Zodiac. Goodbye, Tree of Life. Goodbye, Shape of Water. I'll never love Matt as much for making us review this movie.
Today we're talking about Boyhood, starring Ellen Coltrane, Patricia Arquette, Ethan Hawke, Lorelai Linklater, Libby Valari, Marco Perella, and Brad Hawkins. Directed by Richard Linklater. I am Ryan, one of your hosts here, Cinema Talk Podcast.
I'm Brennan, one of your hosts here on the Cinema Talk Podcast.
Call back to the end of last CDP.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys...
Oh, man.
If you guys
I forgot about that.
Check that one out. Yeah, I'm Matthew.
And I'm Logan.
And Brennan's really bad at saying his own name.
Yes, he is.
So we are back for the third week of our individual picks. This time it is over or underrated movies. So far we've only done overrated movies. So I did the Tree of Life a couple weeks ago. Logan did The Shape of Water last week. And now we are here to Matt's pick, Boyhood.
Yes.
So Matt, tell us why you picked it.
Boyhood. Yeah, continuing with our theme of big Oscar movies that we hate for one reason or another, we've jumped back to 2014
trash.
With Boyhood, which, for some baffling reason, is so widely loved, you know, both critically and I would say, you know, just among the general populace. People really enjoy this movie.
General populace.
And I first saw this film I first saw it in preparation for the Best of the Decade podcast, because I was like, all right, you know, this is one of the big ones. This is the one of the ones that has appeared on a lot of the lists and, you know, one I have to check off. And I just found it to be absolutely terrible, an absolute slog of a film I couldn't comprehend. Like, you know, like Logan and Ryan's reactions to Tree of Life and Shape of Water, I just did not get what the great thing about this movie was. I just didn't get it at all. You know, I've since then watched more of Linklater's movies. I've watched his entire Before trilogy, which me and Boyd have talked about a lot. And I love those movies. I love those movies to death. I thought they were amazing. So it baffles me even further that Boyhood exists. And I can't believe this man, Linklater, spent 12 years making this movie only to just churn out this terrible, terrible film with all these annoying characters, especially this main kid who I just don't like at all. So I'm interested to see, you know, Floyd especially, because I know you're probably going to be the biggest proponent of this film, you know.
Yeah, we'll see
how you feel about it. But I will say, you know, my opinion on this film changed a bit upon second viewing. I found some more merits in it. I will be, you know, a positive towards some things. So I'm not, you know, as negative as I am towards other films.
Yeah. So Brendan and Logan, before I talk about my background, what was your background with this movie?
So I had seen Boyhood fairly recently after it came out. I think it, like, when it came out on DVD, my parents either like got it through the Netflix DVD service, I don't remember if that was still a thing, or like
is still a thing. I'm subscribed to it.
Okay, well, maybe that was how they got it, or somewhere or another my parents got it and they were like, this is like really cool, and it was like the Oscars or whatever, when we really want to watch it. And I was like, all right, whatever guys, I'll watch it. And I remember watching it as like, I don't know, when did this movie come out?
2014.
So I would have been 14 or 15 at the time whenever I watched it, and I remember not liking it and being like, this was stupid. why did we watch this movie? And then I didn't watch it again, and I watched it again for the first time in years last night with my buddy Tim and I.
Keeps,
back on
keep
back
watching
on
those movies together for the
good
pod.
Old Tim.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's a nice way to spend time with your friends who aren't the ones
exactly.
that you talk about the movie with the next day.
Yeah.
Definitely. Fair.
But yeah, that was kind of my experience with the film. And also, Richard Linklater coming out with his Merrily We Roll Along, which he's filming in a similar fashion, which is Sondheim's musical, which I'll be interested to see how that holds up, because, you know, it's a similar project to this, filming it over a long period of time. I hope it's not going to
be... Is that what he's shooting over 27 garbage. Years right now?
Yes.
It's a okay. He's shooting a musical over 27
mm-hmm.
years? What the fuck? Weird.
Yes, indeed.
Hmm.
It's a cool musical. It's great.
Okay. Yeah, interesting.
So like Brendan, I saw this fairly recently, like fairly soon after it came out. Certainly not in theaters, though. And really did not click with it at all. I knew the tagline coming in. 12 years in the making. Pretty cool. I wanted to watch it for the gimmick. And then I watched it, and, you know, basically all I got out of it was the gimmick. We'll see what my thoughts are this time. you know, but that was certainly my initial reaction, and I did not want to watch it for this podcast, and that is the extent of my experience.
Yeah, so like Brennan and Logan, I had not seen this movie since I was 14 or 15 when I watched it for the first time. I remember really liking it then, not fully connecting to it, I don't think. I mean, it is a kind of weird movie to watch when you're 14 or 15, if you think about it, in terms of, like, where the movie's trying to get at. I probably didn't fully appreciate it then, in some ways, in terms of what it was going for. But, you know, it was an Oscar movie, and it was right when I was getting into movies, so I watched it, and I liked it. And coming into this podcast, you know, I was open-minded either way in terms of whether or not I was going to like this movie. It kind of felt like a first viewing almost again. I mean, a first viewing where you know everything that happens but don't remember if it was good or not. So, yeah, we'll get into whether or not I liked it this time. But, yeah, so I guess we will go into the plot summary, of course. For Boyhood, movie shot over 12 years.
12 years in the making.
Filmed over 12 years with the same cast, Richard Linklater's Boyhood is a groundbreaking story of growing up as seen through the eyes of a child named Mason, played by Ellery Coltrane, who literally grows up on screen before our eyes. Starring Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette as Mason's parents and newcomer Lorelai Linklater as his sister Samantha, Boyhood charts the rocky terrain of childhood like no other film has before. Snapshots of adolescence, from road trips and family dinners to birthdays and graduations and all the moments in between, become transcendent, set to a soundtrack spanning the years from the Coldplay's Yellow to Arcade Fire's Deep Blue. Boyhood is both a nostalgic time capsule of the recent past and an ode to growing up and parenting. That was via IMDb and IFC Films, which you can definitely hear the marketing push in that little synopsis there. But I guess we'll go Matt last. So Logan, Brendan, what were your thoughts on Boyhood?
I don't know. I also didn't really like it this viewing. There's no point to the movie. I mean, Logan, you sent something in our Snapchat group chat, which I thought was very funny. There's a part where after Sheena cheats on Mason, they're sitting there and she's like, "This is pointless." And you said, "You said it, movie." And I was like, "Yeah, you're right. You really hit the nail on the head there." It's just, I get it. I get what they were trying to do. But, like, honestly, what would have been more interesting is if you took, like, a real person's life and just cut together home video that they recorded every year. Like, I would have preferred that to this movie. Because, like, at least then I would have been like, okay, this is just someone's life, not just, like, a shitty thing with no story. And, like, there were some interesting things. Like, you saw, like, the cycle of abuse and, like, things, but all of that felt like really like bashing you over the head with a hammer. And it feels like you had 12 years to make this movie and to like course correct through any of it, and like maybe even film some additional footage while you were trying to do it. I don't know. Maybe that's just thinking too positively about it, but like he had 12 years and he's still just like, oh man, he just did not write a satisfying movie at all. I didn't like it on the second viewing.
A really interesting fun fact about this, I don't know if you guys know this, this was actually shot over 12 years.
Really?
I'm not sure if anyone's ever mentioned that.
Wow, great.
Yeah,
thanks.
That's it. That's the good thing that I'll be saying about it. No, I find it very strange that there are pretty much three of us that are going to be really negative on this one, because, like Matt said, it's not just a popular movie, like 97% on Rotten Tomatoes among critics. It's, even among fans, it's got an 80%, which I feel like is really good and just
baffling. It's high for a movie like this.
Very high for a movie like this, which makes it makes me feel like I'm missing something, and I definitely feel like I get it. Like, there are a lot of people with this one that are like, oh, well, if you don't like it, like, you just didn't get it. And first of all, fuck everyone who's ever said that about any movie, because that's just such a dumb thing to say. But unless it's me saying it, then it's
valid.
Then it's the most smart thing that anyone's ever said.
Cinematography.
I get it. I just don't like it. I might even be... So, I don't think that I'm more negative this time. I just think I have a much better way of explaining it now. Like, you know, all of our early podcasts, if you go back and listen to them, we don't really have anything good to say for the most part. At least I don't. You know, I'm the other guys might. But I wouldn't know because I haven't listened to them in a while. And
dude, I avoid them like the plague.
They're bad.
Right? Because now, I mean, we've talked about, this is our, what, 65th, 66th episode?
I think 66.
66. Mm. Execute Order 66. And
we should be reviewing Revenge of the Sith. What are we doing?
We really should. We should be revisiting Revenge of the Sith. But no, I mean, you know, we've talked about movies so much now at this point. I feel like I'm very good at discussing them. And as I'm watching, I'm good at, you know, figuring out what I like and don't like. So I do have more structured arguments than just, like, it's boring, nothing happens, which was essentially my first time going through it. But now that I've typed out all my notes, I have even more of an extreme hatred for this because I know just how little happens and how much of this I don't like.
Oh, yeah, I'm so used to going last, it is me. So, I have to say, I was wrong before. I was really wrong. I was wrong to not put this in my top 10 of the decade. This is a absolutely fantastic film. It hit me so hard.
Damn.
When I watched it last night. It wrecked me in a lot of ways. I was crying by the end pretty consistently. It really just kind of put me in this amazing headspace that I just stayed up for a while after it and just like kind of thought about life for a while, and it put me in this incredible mindset. Richard Linklater, I think I've only seen this movie in the Before trilogy, and honestly, this guy, there's just something about it, about his films, that just feel so real and really communicate what it's like to age and what it's like to be a different person at different points in your life. And, you know, the Before trilogy are very specific moments in a relationship. You know, there's the first time, there's that, like, the joy and Before Sunrise of, like, just meeting someone and having this amazing connection with them. Before Sunset, reconnecting with someone, and then I won't spoil what Before Midnight is about because, I mean, it's kind of a plot point in Before Sunset. But just at least for those first two, and then, you know, and also Before Midnight, just not saying the context, those are very specific moments. I mean, the fact that all of those movies take place over maximum, like, 8 hours, I think, each movie, to then go to this movie, which is almost like a coda. It came out a year after Before Midnight, and instead of hyper-focused on specific moments in terms of time, it's spread out over 12 years. And
is it really?
Yeah, it is. It is really? Spread out over 12 years.
That's a long time to be filming. Huh.
And yeah, and just Linklater's actual letting these movies marinate, either between films or during the actual film, and seeing the difference in people's lives. There's something in these four movies that you literally can't manufacture. It is you have to make a movie this way for it to be impactful in this way. Which is, I mean, like, I love Barry Jenkins' Moonlight. Great movie. Doesn't hit me anywhere near the same way when you have three separate actors play that. If Barry Jenkins was like Richard Linklater, was like, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to film it over 20 years, it probably would hit me that hard. But there is a disconnect when you're watching a movie and you see different time periods played by different actors. And, like, no matter what, even in The Irishman, when it's de-aging, it still feels different. There is something magical about watching someone age in front of you on a screen. And, I mean, we'll get into the specifics of the movie, but, yeah, this solidified itself as one of my favorite movies.
Damn. Well, you know, I don't like to hate on movies that people, you know, specifically have personal connections to. When people,
it's a
like
reverse tree of life.
When people like movies that, like, it's not just like, oh, I love this movie. It's like, no, I love this movie because it hits me this way and it reminds me of this. It's like, oh, now I feel kind of shitty for criticizing it. But
yeah.
I am happy that you've had that experience with that movie, because, you know, I have had that experience like that with other movies, and I know that feeling and I love that feeling. That being said, this movie just doesn't impact me at all. You talked a lot about, you know, just how natural it feels to you, and how the aging and all the scenes don't feel manufactured at all. For me, it's the complete opposite. I don't know how he spent 12 years with these actors and still managed to make so many of these scenes feel so staged. And because I know he has such a talent for making those very naturalistic scenes, as seen in the Before trilogy, which I love. But here, I just felt none of that. I felt absolutely none of it. I thought this film really just danced around on different topics. It felt mostly to me like a checklist, like a coming-of-age movie checklist. Like, okay, we got loss of innocence, check.
Have
bullying,
an evil alcoholic
check.
Stepdad.
Marital strife, check. Two you know, and it just like it just felt
two
like it
of
was
them.
It just felt like it was knocking off those marks without ever delving deep into it. You know, a main issue for me was this kid. He was cute when he was little, you know, he was entertaining when he was in kindergarten, and then I just could not stand the hell out of him when he got older. He was so freaking annoying. I just wanted to slap him by the end of the movie when his mom was crying and he didn't even get over there to give her a hug or anything. He's so annoying. I don't like him. There's a review on Letterboxd I want to read that I think epitomizes kind of how I feel about this movie. And this is from the user Adrian Balboa. What I would give to see Linklater's face when he realized the kid that he invested 12 years in turned out to be emo. That's how I feel about this. As Brendan said, what is the point? The movie ends and I don't, I'm not holding on to anything. I'm not feeling it. I don't know
Matt,
what to grasp
Matt,
onto.
You're just not getting it.
Maybe I'm just not getting it. It's filmed over 12 years? Oh,
it is.
Oh,
yes,
okay.
That's the thing.
Did you hear? I'm not sure if you hear. Hold on. We just need to clarify something really quickly.
Just rumor control.
Rumor control. Filmed over 12? Am I getting that right?
I think it's 12. More than 11 and one less
yes,
than 13.
And
so
then it
yes,
would be
12.
12. 12 years.
12 years, a boy.
12 whole
yep.
years. Wow.
Which they wanted to call the movie 12 Years.
Really?
But it came out, they were making it, it was called 12 Years. Because I've heard a lot of criticism of this movie being like, oh, the main actor is uninteresting. I feel like a lot of the mindset, he is definitely the main character, where a lot of the mindset of like, this is about the boy, comes from the title. But
yes,
the movie was initially going to be called 12 Years. But the movie that won Best Picture, 12 Years a Slave, the year before, kind of put an end to that. You can't have a movie come out called 12 Years the year after a movie called 12 Years a Slave, so...
Wait, which movie did this one lose to, then? I thought it was 12 Years a Slave.
2014 would have been Birdman.
Yeah.
Really? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
Yeah, lost to Birdman.
But yeah, we'll get into it later, but that's kind of my overview of my thoughts on this movie.
Yeah, see, the thing is, I feel like most movies that, I mean, this doesn't happen too often where I'm the only positive and all three of you are negative. Normally it's Matt. Normally Matt's on the island, so I'm not too, honestly, like, there are some podcasts that I go into where I'm like, okay, I know I have a strong opinion about this and I know that others disagree. I feel like I need to prepare. I didn't feel the need to prepare for this because this movie feels, it just feels so different in terms of the arguments that you're going to throw at it. I just know that I disagree. And this isn't the kind of movie and the kind of podcast that it's going to be like, oh, this technically didn't work for me. Well, and it's like, oh, but this is technically brilliant. No, it's like this movie either hits you or it doesn't. These moments either feel like moments from your life, which they do for me. Like, so much of this movie feels like just I'm watching my life on a movie screen, which is very surreal and a very weird thing to do. That it either does that for you or it doesn't. So, I don't think this makes necessarily too much sense to be going through this movie linearly, since there isn't too much of like plot. But I guess I'll turn it over to you guys. What are your main criticisms of this movie, and what would you like to talk about first? Specifically, Matt, since it's your pick.
Yeah, I can start off, and this is a problem I kind of have in the very beginning of the movie. I touched on this. I feel like this movie just doesn't dive deep enough into these coming-of-age cliches that it so desperately wants to explore. You know, for me, this just felt like, as I said, a checklist. I felt like they were just knocking these things off that I've seen explored in so many deeper ways in other movies. Specifically, the start of this movie. You know, we get to another criticism of this, which is the way they use music in this movie. They throw in like Yellow, one of the most like emotionally exploitative songs ever. They keep it in there for about 10 seconds and they fade it out quick, which is what they do with every single song in this movie. They never use it impactfully. They keep it there for like 10 seconds. And then within the span of 7 minutes, we get hit with so many coming of age movie cliches that aren't even like developed well. Like, there's one shot of The kid. What's the kid's name?
Mason.
I'm really bad with character.
Oh, wait. Sorry, Matt. I don't want to interrupt too much, but just before we really get rolling, we were talking about this in our group chat. We mentioned this with Perks of Being a Wallflower with... what's his name? I'm totally forgetting, but...
Ezra Miller.
Logan Lerman's character?
Ezra Miller. Nope, Ezra Miller. So Eller Coltrane now uses they-them pronouns. Since the character uses he-him in this movie, that's what we're going to be doing, so... Just not to totally gloss over that, but yeah.
Yes, we are aware that Eller Coltrane uses they, them. It's only because of the context of this movie that we're using he, him to describe the character of Mason.
Yes. Yeah, the character is Cy Male.
Yep. Yes. Film. Yes. But continue, Matt. Sorry.
No, yeah, yes. It's good to bring awareness to that. Thank you. There's this random shot of him kind of in an alley or something, and he just looks down at a dead bird, and the shot lingers there for about 3 seconds, and they cut. And it felt like Linklater was like, okay, we need to, finite nature of life. How are we gonna, okay, dead bird, quick, 3 seconds, check it off, move on. And then, let's get hit with another cliche. They need to go graffiti things underneath a bridge. Now we gotta show a girl that he likes. Marital strife, parents are divorced. It's like all these things that, like,
yeah,
they're just, like, skipping the surface of this. We're not actually grasping any of these things. I didn't feel any of it. So I want to hear what you guys think about that.
My friend Tim was like, is this a thing that kids actually do, like, look at porn together? And I was like, yeah, man, all the time when we were kids. Oh, are you kidding? Just porn every day,
all the time. Porn and graffiti, that's what I would call a regular Wednesday afternoon when I was six.
Yeah, that's such a coming of age movie cliche, sitting around looking at the old porn magazines, and then we're gonna go on the swing set and laugh about it. It just, like, this beginning especially just feels so summery.
I agree with you, Matt. It seems, you know, at once this movie seems very cheesy and then also very, like, not cheesy. Like, it wants to be so, like, hyper-realistic, and it sometimes is, I guess. But then also some parts of it are so cheesy, and it somehow gets the worst of both of those for me. I do want to, Ryan, if you want to talk at all about this, sort of the cliche nature of any of the stuff. And then I definitely want to mention the music.
Yes.
Yeah, the only scene, we talked about this off mic, that I really didn't like was the older kids scene when they were, like, in 8th grade, sitting around that abandoned house. That was bad scene.
The acting in that scene is, like,
The
same acting quality you would see in a drug PSA commercial.
Yep.
It really was. It felt like it was, and it was really bad.
It was bad.
But other than that, I have no idea.
The old kid?
Yeah, we don't see any of them again. None of it matters. What effect does that scene have on the rest of the movie? Nothing.
Nothing.
I mean, it kind of does. We can get into these moments as we go through it. But in terms of the cliche nature, I disagree, because all of these moments feel real. Like you said about the Tree of Life, Matt, I feel like this is my Tree of Life.
I was thinking
all of these moments just feel real. These are just, they feel like memories from this kid. In honestly the same way that I have my memories about my childhood growing up. A lot of things, obviously it's not clean parallel, but it is a very, I've experienced a lot of things that this kid goes through.
Mm-hmm.
Even to the small things, like you guys were joking around, but that thing of looking at porn with your friends when you're 11, yeah, that happened with, like, that was kind of a thing, when, at least for me and my, you know, when I was 11.
Now we know. I don't think that's that weird to say
because everyone, you know, you see that kind of thing for the first time at some point, so it didn't feel out of place. The scene, the dead bird. I remember an experience very similar to that of seeing a dead bird in my driveway for the first time. It was very confounding and weird. You know, moving. I didn't move when I was a kid, but I remember people moving away. And I remember having, just like from when I was 4 or 5, just like it feels just like a flash the way that that it happens in the film. And the very beginning of the film, too, when he has to paint over, you know, the different
that is an effective moment.
That's a very effective moment. These kind of moments, and the annoying older sister, felt very much like my sister in some ways. So yeah, like, and all of these moments when he's very young feel real, which is why I think that once you get to the older section, it works so well. And I think that just for me, none of the moments felt cliche except for that after school special scene. But yeah, so I'll let you guys, if you want to point out anything specific.
I'm glad you brought up the Tree of Life, because I was wondering if this was going to come up, but
yes,
both set in Texas, both, you know, coming-of-age elements. I'm talking about, like, the latter part of the Tree of Life, the last, like, two-thirds, sort of.
I mean, the universe came of age in that movie, too.
Right. There's, like, themes of parental abuse. There's no real, like, conventional storyline. It's sort of more of a collection of experiences. I think what differentiates it for me, I was trying to think about this. I was like, these in theory are very similar things, but I don't know why they're different. I think for me, the Tree of Life is shot a lot more like a memory, or a lot more how I imagine my memories. You know, I don't have, you know, full scenes laid out. It was you'd kind of get bits and pieces of things. Well, when you're a kid, you move around a lot, so
sure,
yeah, you kind of a lot of camera movement. You know, and it wasn't trying to be like a point of view or anything like that. You know, we don't have to go back and rehash the whole Tree of Life conversation, but just to draw
we could try.
To draw some comparisons and points of contradiction, but I don't know. I feel like Boyhood has good cinematography. Like, it's professional. I've never watched a professionally made movie and been like, this is awful cinematography. Like, yeah, it's professional level. I think it's nothing very special. The Tree of Life is shot in a very, like, memory-like way, because it is, you know, Sean Penn as an adult. It's his memory. I think Boyhood wants to just be, like, a telling of events, and mm-hmm. I think that doesn't really work as well. The collection of experiences really works when it's framed as, like, a collection of memories, but I think as a narrative...
That is the way that Linklater was shooting it. That's the way that he said that he was envisioning this, was the 18-year-old looking back in some ways. He said he wanted it to feel like a collection of memories, which for me it did.
Yeah, but for me it just doesn't. So that's just I don't know, Matt, because you were the other person. I mean, you love the Tree of Life, but what do you think is the big difference?
Yeah, I was thinking about these comparisons as well, and in terms of the cinematography, you know, I don't have any problem with it. I understand, yeah. Obviously, Linklater went about it intentionally, trying to, I would say, film this in a very, like, indescript way, you know, just in a kind of fly on the wall. He does kind of the same thing with the Before trilogy. There's nothing too mm-hmm. fancy going on.
Feels very similar.
Yeah. But for me, there's a scene where Mason asks Ethan Hawke, you know, is there magic in the world? You know,
no.
Does that exist? And Ethan Hawke responds, and he's like, no, but, you know, how are elves any more magical than a blue whale? And he kind of, like, talks about, like, hey, there's magic in this world. It's out there. And for me, that was something that Tree of Life captured really well. That, like, and, you know, specifically that movie was more about God and spiritual, but, like, the magic in everyday life. And I never felt any of that spark in this movie, which is why I think this felt so lifeless to me. And it just felt like just such a slog. And I think Tree of Life worked because, these movies are similar in that they touch on certain topics without, like, necessarily diving into it very deep. And in Tree of Life, you know, we see the kid drown, and then we don't find out what happens after that. You know, we see, like, snippets of what might happen, but it doesn't necessarily, like, dive into this one kid's life. But it worked for me in Tree of Life because that movie was framed so much as just a visual poem, as we were going to show you, you know, these bits and shreds of memories and kind of dance around intentionally. And like Logan was saying, the way that this movie is framed, you know, much more narratively and traditionally, it just feels very lame. It just feels like poor writing to me to not, you know, when they just, like, touch on these little instances without delving into them. And I think that's where my problem with it lies. And obviously, Tree of Life and this, two very different movies, and I think, you know, maybe some of it might come down to just personal preference. But
yeah, no, I like what you said about Tree of Life having it shows the magic in mundane life, and I think Boyhood just tries to show mundane life, and that's kind of what people like about it. But for me, it's just not a very interesting thing to
see. No, I think it shows the magic of mundane life, honestly. Yeah,
but see, it's not that.
Are there any
Boyhood
moments
has to be,
like,
shot like Tree of Life? And it has to, you know, show the magic in this amazing, spectacular, off-the-wall cinematography. But it just through the script as well and through these characters who I felt were very lifeless. I never felt any sort of magic in Mason's character. Okay. Like that, like, if he is supposed to be...
No, I did.
If the movie is supposed to vocalize around Mason, I don't feel any magic from a character that just drones on about how, you you know, nihilistically about how this society is all evil and they're putting chips in us and we're all going to be robots. Like, after like 20 minutes of hearing this, it's like, oh, like, you're just an annoying person that like someone avoids at a party. Like, how am I supposed to feel attached to you?
Now, I think, honestly, towards the beginning, I do feel attached to this character. I think he's a very, very interesting character. Some of the things that they talk about are like very, the parts that I feel are relatable. You know, he's staring out the window in class. He's, you know, he's not paying attention because he's bored, basically. He doesn't like doing, like, the boring, you know, tracing and cutting assignments because he wants to be doing, like, more in his classes intellectually. That's what I found interesting about the character. And then he just turns into this weird emo kid. And, like, it's... I feel like we all know, like, people who talk, like, man, I just want to, like, unplug. I want to get off Facebook. I don't want to live my life through a screen. And, like, I feel like the people who talk like that aren't the people that I'm like, wow, I'm very connected to you as a character. It's like, you weirdo, stop being so stuck up about this. Like, yeah, obviously, I don't want to live my life entirely through a screen either, but, like, I'm not going to be this, like, weird, stuck-up person about it. I don't know. I think he transforms into a person who is... at least for me, not relatable. And if he is relatable for some people, that's fine. But I think regardless, a film shouldn't hinge that much on whether, you know, individual people can relate to it, you know, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
I mean, attachment to main character is kind of what any movie is.
Yeah, but it shouldn't 100% hinge on that, you know?
I don't think it does, first of all. But second of all, I like this kid. I think he's, even when he is being obnoxious and annoying, it feels like he's, like, you're his uncle or something, just, like, kind of there for all these scenes, just, like, kind of watching this kid grow up. Like, yeah, he's gonna make mistakes, and he turns into Ethan Hawke by the end of the movie. Like, I think it's very obvious that he is becoming his dad by the end of the movie, which is a very relatable and thing that happens. A lot of people, you know, go against their parents only to become like their parents, because that's what it's kind of like to grow up. But I think, Logan, you asked for specific moments. I forget about example of what.
Like, what's magic? The finding the magic in the mundane, and it's not just mundane.
Yeah, well, for me, the magic element isn't... In the Tree of Life... Terrence Malick is really, like, trying to show you, like, visually, just constantly, just, like, all this crazy, like, trying to literally just make magic out of something that's not. Here, the magic in it for me is that Linklater doesn't try to do that. He is just showing you these moments in someone's life, and that is what makes it connect with me. I think it's an aesthetic choice that I just prefer.
Okay.
Like, Tree of Life is like, trying to constantly tell you, like, look at me directing this. Here, it just feels like you are watching someone's life, which will always be more profound for me. It'll always feel more profound just to watch someone do something like this than have the just obnoxious, I think, camera work and direction by Malick.
I think my thing with it, though, is that there's still no point. And I'm of the camp, obviously, if you listen to our Tree of Life podcast, you know, I don't like either of these movies. So, yes, you can watch both of these movies and not like either of them. You, too, can be a smelly asshole. but I think my main problem with it...
We need t-shirts that say, you, too, can be a smelly asshole.
You, too, can be... And it just has my face on it. Yes. Just like, yeah. But I think my problem with it, my main problem with it, though, is that, like, yes, it feels less directed. It does feel more natural, and I can appreciate that, because I definitely didn't like that about the Tree of Life, because it felt so masturbatory. But at the same time, there's just no point. Like, there's no, like,
the point is seeing the kid grow up.
But there's no development to the kid growing up other than he gets older and his hair changes. I, like, you know, I would be so invested, because there are so many parts of this movie where it's like, I can kind of buy, like, okay, yeah, like, living in these abusive households and, like, shit turned him into an emo kid. But, like, then, like, I just wish that we got inside with him more, you know? Like, there is just so many things about this movie that I'm like, where did these traits come from? Like, why did we smash cut into him smoking in the back of a car and making out with a girl? Why is then he, like, drinking all the time if he's been surrounded by alcoholic, like, assholes his entire life? It's... I just think that, like, it's trying to show these cycles, like, in all of these different ways, but it's not showing them in a way that means anything in the end.
I think part of that comes, probably my biggest problem. I think when we see those developments, we just see, like, we don't see him developing really as a character. We just see after he's developed each step. It feels like we're, this is going to be a super weird analogy, and it might be hard to get into it, but this is honestly the best way that I can, like, visualize it. You know those in airports, like the conveyor belts that you stand on, and it helps you, I don't know, just like speed things up a little bit?
Yeah.
Feels like we and Mason are in two different buildings. We're on conveyor belts at the same time, and through the window, we can see him like every once in a while. And obviously, I'm not asking for this movie to show us everything in 18 years, but like, it's like we're not even seeing the important things. We're just seeing kind of a collection of things that happened, and it's not like they even really had much bearing on his, you know, who he becomes. We just kind of see, like, these weird glimpses into, and it's seemingly at random.
I think by the end of the movie, Linklater tells you why it is that way, why we are getting these insignificant moments, quote-unquote insignificant moments, minus a couple things, in this kid's life. It's to contrast the kind of mindset that a lot of people have. And the Patricia Arquette character, the mom character, beautifully says it at the end. It's the scene that won her Oscar, where she says, "My life has just been a series of milestones." And this movie is showing you all the moments in between. That is where you live your life. That is where you develop as a person. Those times where you're just sitting there by yourself in your room, thinking about things. That time where you have to avoid a situation that you don't want to be in, whether it be an abusive stepdad in this movie or something else, family strife, whatever, where you just have to sit there and be quiet, because that's just what you have to do. And as an 11-year-old, you can't do anything else about it. Showing the big milestone felt so much more impactful, because it felt like you actually lived the life with the kid. You saw the moments in between where he actually changed, and that's what made it so impactful. Not that you saw him like have sex for the first time or drink for the first time. You guys are saying it's going for all these cliches. We don't see things like that, because in the end, Linklater's arguing that those aren't the moments that matter.
But me watching the movie and getting to the end and feeling like there is no point, I'm like, yeah, maybe those moments do matter. Maybe I wanted to see that from this person's life. Maybe that's a me problem. I don't know, right. But part of it, yeah, go ahead, Matt.
I was gonna say, like, I get that mindset, Floyd, and I get what he's going for, but when the movie, as we said, hinges so much on this main character, the movie is, I mean, it's called Boyhood, for God's sake. And
wasn't supposed to be.
But it is.
But it was.
Yeah. I mean, they could have picked something different, you know?
Time.
They could have called it 144 months if they wanted to, if they really wanted to do it like the time.
They could have said adolescence. Who knows?
1.2 decades.
What, did you say 1.2 decades?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, because that's a much better title than Boyhood.
That hooks him in. The Oscar winner, 1.2 decades.
A decade or so.
You know, but if I'm going to be seeing so much of these insignificant moments, you know, which I think is, all right, that's a cool perspective to take into the movie, that has to amount to something in the main character. And when and I don't need this kid to have a full-out, you know, change of character and have a complete different perspective on the world by the end. But when the movie ends with him still griping on about the same old shit.
Oh, it doesn't, though.
And when the movie, like, in the scene that you're talking about, right, Patricia Arquette, I don't think she should have won an Oscar. I think she's good in the movie. I think both her and Ethan Hawke are the best things about this movie. Ethan Hawke specifically. Totally. I love
Ethan Hawke is fantastic.
Especially after watching the Before trilogy, I was like, oh, Jesse. I was like, what are you doing?
I know.
Jesse. Like, I
love
that.
They're kind of the same character in some ways.
Well, and there's also kind of a criticism with it. It's like, I feel like he kind of just plays the same person, which I don't really mind because I do love it. Right? Yeah. But, like, in that scene where she's, like, breaking down and having this moment, I would have felt emotionally impacted if the kid then kind of, like, felt that same sort of reaction in himself and he realized, okay, you know, maybe it is, you know, he understands what the movie is saying. He's like, you know what? Maybe it is the insignificant moments that mattered. And him and his mom had some sort of moment there. I can't stand the kid in that scene because his mom is crying in the corner on the seat and he just stands there and gripes on and complains. He doesn't even go over to hug her or something. It's enraging. That is, like, the seen why I really can't stand this kid. Because he didn't give her a hug or anything. I just could not stand that moment. If he would have, like, recognized in that scene, recognized her pain, and, like, he wouldn't even have to say anything. Just gone over there, like, put a hand on her shoulder or something. That would have been enough of a signifier to be like, okay, I see some sort of change in this character. You know, that would have helped out the ending a lot for me.
I think one of the things that really riles me up about that specific scene, and this is a thing that we can talk about other examples of this in the movie, but she goes, he brings out like some photograph and she's like, oh, it's the first picture you ever took. Like, maybe we could have seen him take it, and then that would have given us, you know, like any more emotional attachment to this. The same thing
can't
with like,
go back and shoot that afterwards though.
What do you mean?
Faults of 12-year movie.
You can't just like all of a sudden be like, oh shit. Wait, we gotta go back and film this.
Don't put it in the script.
Yeah, then don't put it in the script. Then you could have filmed it. You could have had a script ready to go, and then you could have.
Or like maybe.
No, this movie would not have worked as well if you had a script going in.
Okay, well, I want to get to that in a sec. But some other examples, like he's in the car talking to his dad, and he's like, "You said this was gonna be my car." Like, didn't get to see that. We just sort of have to take his word for it. This is the thing. There's like the old adage with, like parenting. Like it's a little cliche, but I kind of like it. It's like. As a parent, like, you have to act like everything that your kid tells you is super important, because to them it is. You know, your kid comes home and is showing you their cool sharpened rocks, like in that one kind of cute scene with Ethan Hawke.
Kind of like, cute? God, my heart melted.
You gotta act like that is the most important thing in the world, because to Mason, that is the most important thing in the world. Okay, so going with that, like, if we would have seen that moment of the dad promising the car to him, and then later it absolutely would have hit harder. With Ethan Hawke saying, sorry, I just don't remember that. You know, or there's a character, there's like some cousin that they have, and Samantha's like, oh my god, Abby, I can't believe you're 13. Had we ever seen Abby
before?
Well,
that's not a cousin, it's just a friend.
Well, wasn't that random? I will say, that was the little girl that was singing High School
Musical. It was, yeah.
So, we do see her, briefly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sure. It's just such a long
Yeah, it's
movie.
That family that they go to after they leave the professor. The
that makes a little more sense.
So they didn't bring him back.
Yeah, he's on his senior trip.
Sure.
Yeah, right. He's playing Wii Sports still.
Yeah, still.
still playing Wii Boxing, which was an amazing moment.
But yeah, no, I just feel like there's some things... I don't know. Do you have something to say about that before we get to talking about the lack of a script?
Yeah, in terms of... What specific point would you like me to counter?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you have anything, it's
I mean,
funny to, but like,
are you,
just about
I kinda,
about like not, you know, we hear a lot of things that we haven't seen set up before, and I feel like it lacks.
Yeah,
like,
that's
it might just
that's
be another
fair criticism, thing, you know. But it didn't bother me. I think maybe you would have been right with that scene with the dad if there had been a scene with the dad saying like, this is gonna be your car. But honestly. For me, I didn't need that scene to be in there because you could see that from Ethan Hawke's change in his persona. Because Ethan Hawke changes his, like, completely changes the person that he is throughout these 12 years. So, the person that Ethan Hawke is at the beginning of the movie, I could see saying that and then forgetting in those 12 years. Because I'm sure that I've had these kind of conversations with my dad.
Yeah,
and I think that's one of the reasons why so many scenes in this movie like impacted me is because like Ethan Hawke feels like a real dad, and Patricia Arquette feels like a real mom, and kind of in some ways similar to my own parents. And while I'm not really anything like Eller Coltrane's character, it feels like there is this connection to this kid through having like many shared experiences. Which again, this is a hyper specific. Personal to me reaction to the film that I mean by also percentages a lot most other people felt connected to this movie. I don't know if it was for the same reason that I did because of having shared experiences, but in just random moments too, just like laying on when you're a little kid of a divorced family, laying on the bed with your mom saying, do you still love dad? Like I have very vivid memories of having those kind of conversations. The idea of just like going to go bowling, for me it was golfing with my dad when you're 8 or 9 years old and you have these, you know, you don't see him all the time because you live with your mom. These kind of moments like in the childhood, and then when you get older, that moment that you talked about laying on the couch asking about magic, I had the same conversation with my dad in a townhouse, like laying on the couch with my divorced parents with my dad, asking him a very similar question. I think it was about Santa when I was like 9 or 10. Like,
yeah, that happened to me. It is
these kind of moments, seeing these moments recreated on screen is what is so impactful to me. And that's why I'm saying these are the bigger moments to me. These are the kind of moments that I remember. The kind of moments where your family is arguing downstairs and you have to hide upstairs because the kids were told to go upstairs while the parents fought it out, you know, while the parents were yelling at each other. You had to go up there with your either siblings, step-siblings, whatever, and just sit there and have to be quiet and listen to it. Those are the kind of moments that develop you as a person. And those were the moments that I think of when I think back on my childhood. The reason why this movie is so impactful is because this movie gets it. This movie understands what I remember. This is the thing that I disagree, like, why I just don't buy into the Tree of Life, is because, like, that's not how my memory works, and that's not, those aren't the kind of things that I remember, just like, oh, you know, having to do yard work or whatever, and you know, being edgy and those kind of things. Obviously, if I saw a kid die drown in a pool, I would remember that. But like, you know, but for me, like, and then the music too, there's so many songs in this movie that I, when they came on, I was like, yes, like, holy shit, I didn't even know I forgot that. Like, in terms of, like 1901 by the Phoenix, or, like, this great song just pops in. I'm like, holy shit, that was a song when I was 12. I'm looking through my notes of, like, other moments that really, really hit me.
No, yeah, Floyd, to what you're saying, I hear what you're saying. And most of the parts that you're describing there are mostly kind of from the middle portion of the movie, which I will give credit to. You know, a majority of the middle was kind of spent with Ethan Hawke, and I think that is when the movie is at its strongest. There was a point, kind of in the middle, when him and Ethan Hawke are going camping, you know, swimming, that, like, I wasn't taking notes.
Beautiful.
I wasn't taking notes for a while, and I went, do I like not hate this movie anymore? And then, like, it got bad for me in the end, and I was like, ah, man, like, this sucks. Like, it really ends really terribly for me. But I will say, you know, I do think that it is at its best in the middle. Because I think Ethan Hawke is a really strong, just natural actor on the screen. And you know, yeah, I mean, I can't really argue against that. I do understand what you're saying. You know, also as a child of divorced parents, there were a lot of moments in here that I was like, yeah, that's pretty accurate. But I mean,
that's how it goes.
Yeah, yeah. No, I understand that completely. But yeah, I think it maybe just comes down to personal memory and preference. But yeah,
yeah. Yeah, like, other moments that really hit me, too, in terms of that time was, like, when he gets a little older. Like, having the older, I think maybe just that it was that, like, this is a very similar situation. Like, it is a mom-dad divorce with an older sister by, like, 2 or 3 years. That is just, like, it's literally my family structure that it hit me so hard. But, like, even, like, I feel like my dad is not like Ethan Hawke in the beginning. My dad is like Ethan Hawke at the end. So, like, seeing Ethan Hawke develop into my dad was very weird. Because, like having conversations like he does, well, like, he takes him to go see a baseball game, and that feels very real, because that was something that I did with my dad all the time. Going camping, I never went camping with my dad, but having those conversations, it's, like, this is what I'm saying, where it's, like, I don't, like, everyone has a different life experience. This movie felt like it was reflecting back on me what I had experienced, and that's why it hit me so hard. And to the point where the scene near the end where he's talking to his dad at the pre-show, and, you know, he offers him a beer. He's like, you know, you can have one if you want, you know. He's like, you know, it's fine, I'm good with water. And then they have this conversation about life and how things change, and having a conversation about, you know, the girlfriend that just dumped you. Like, again, these are moments that I've had in my life. You know, but again, not to get too specific, but, like, yeah, these are actual, like, at every point, these are conversations that I have and moments that I've had. Yes. So, even the moments of, like, going to church, when you're older and you kind of realize, like, you don't gel with this kind of mentality, and, like, your parents definitely do on some level. Again, these are the moments that I'm talking about that I think, if you were looking, Logan, if you were looking for earlier, what, like, the moments that feel magical, I think that's, these are all these moments, and I'm even leaving a couple out that I felt very connected to.
Sure.
Towards the latter half of the film.
So I want to pivot a little bit, unless anyone has anything, but we mentioned the script a little bit ago. I don't know, I was trying to look into the production history of this. How much of a script did they have at the beginning? You know, how much of this was unscripted? I figured when it got to the end and there wasn't really an ending, I kind of had a sneaking suspicion, like, yeah, he didn't know where he was going with this. What was it like? Does anyone know?
Yeah, I do. So they went into it, they casted the whole film. And they had he had a rough endpoint. I think what he knew is that he wanted it to end with him going to college.
Okay.
And he wrote it very similarly to the Before trilogy. He would write for 1 year. He would kind of stew in that mindset. He was like, okay, like I watched an interview with him and he was like, you know, okay, Mason's in fourth grade. What he put himself in a mindset for a year of like, what would it be like to be going through fourth grade right now? And then he would write the scenes for that year as they went through that year leading up to the shoot. As Eller Coltrane got older, he actually recruited him to basically write the movie with him, and which is what he did with the Before trilogy. Like the Before Midnight is written by Richard Linklater, Julie Delpy, and Ethan Hawke. Mm-hmm. Like it's because it is basically just a conversation between Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy, who had been these characters two times before. I think what works so well about this movie is that he said it was interesting to start the movie having to just be like a 7-year-old that you have to, like, you know, look at the camera, do these kind of things. By the end, to just have a full-on collaborator. He said he would, like, you know, when you're having these conversations, because Eller Coltrane would shoot this movie three days out of the year, and then he would go and live his life. And he was like, okay, write down these moments. When you're at a party and you're talking to a girl, like, write down these moments. And I'm assuming why it feels real to me, the moment, like, when he is talking to, when Mason's talking to the girl who ends up becoming his girlfriend, I forget what her name was.
Sheena.
Sheena, thank you. When they're having that conversation, it feels real because I think probably Eller Coltrane had that conversation. So that was the writing process. They wrote it basically each year chunk before the year that they were going to be shooting it.
Yeah. I think Matt touched on it a little bit. I mean, I'll let you talk about this certainly, Matt or Brendan, but yeah, it feels like I definitely get that sense. Like, it feels like each time they're sort of skipping around to something different and they never really get too deep into it. And then, you know, overall, I feel like there's no real direction other than going.
Does your life have a plot? Yeah, that's my point.
No, but that's the thing. I don't think
it's a movie.
Yeah, right. But movies have plots, you know, and I don't think that.
Yeah, but you like the Tree of Life, and that doesn't have a plot. Like, it doesn't. Like I said,
no, but it has great imagery in it, and it has themes.
Yeah, and this movie doesn't have themes.
It has a lot of underdeveloped themes. Here's the thing. I think that. In film, I want some sort of, you know, I want story. I want drama. Drama comes from, you know, things happening, and it comes from intrigue and tension. This is not a drama. It's not dramatized at all, and it's very unceremonious in the way that it presents nearly everything in it, and that's what people like about it.
Is life unceremonious?
It's different. It is, but this is what I'm saying. I don't think life would make a good movie. I wouldn't want to just put my everyday life on the screen because I don't think that it would be a good film. I think, like, people like it because it presents a movie that's like life, you know, but it's different and it's quirky. And, like, obviously, I'm not going to be the person that's going to say that every film has to be completely by the book and, like, you can't go outside the norms or subvert expectations at all. David Lynch is my favorite director, so, like, you know, like, how am I going to sit here and tell you that everything has got to be this formulaic, you know, 3-act structure, Freytag's pyramid, hero's journey kind of thing. But, like, at the same time, some of these conventions are in place for a reason, and it's because they make stories interesting. They, like, they give them meaning. And I think if you want to substitute those norms with something creative, like Lynch does, then fine. But I feel like you don't get credit for me just for not using the conventions, because now the story is just nothing. Like, it's not clever or outside the box to me. It just doesn't exist, and that's not a good
thing. It's
not
outside the box
to
shoot a movie over 12 years and watch someone grow up?
It's outside the box, but not in a good way. It's not outside the box. There's just not a box.
Yeah, that's... go ahead, Matt.
That's a fair way to put it. I will disagree slightly because, like I said, I love the Before trilogy, and that is people walking around and talking. Like, the Before trilogy is we're going to film people experiencing life. So I'm not going to hate on this movie for going forward with the intention of, you know, filming life. I just think the Before trilogy has so many more charismatic actors who carry that film.
So many more. There's only two actors, really.
Okay, that's true. the before trilogy,
you can buy into the performances more.
The before
trilogy,
two main characters have more charisma than Elijah Coltrane could ever muster up. For this very naturalistic movie, for a filmmaker to go forward and be like, okay, I'm going to film this movie. It's going to be just I'm just going to show life. I want it to be a fly on the wall perspective. One, it's got to feel natural, which for me this movie doesn't. It just feels very staged most of the time. And like it's got to have like a spark to it. And for me, that spark does not exist in the character. And if the Coltrane actor was drawing from experiences, from own conversations he had, from parties for his character, like, that's such a bummer, because this kid is such a bore, and the conversations he has are so boring and so, like, annoying, and it's like, I would not want to have this conversation with someone. Like, I wish there was better material to pull from.
That's the thing. Maybe it's real life, but it's boring. Film isn't, yeah. You know, film presents remarkable stories, and, you know, it doesn't have to be, like, it doesn't have to be fucking superhero sky beams and air punching. You know, it can be... It
Someone
can be more subtle than that.
Three times in one day.
Exactly. I want that movie.
I want that movie too, because it would be something interesting that's happening.
Richard Linklater.
I think just man. Overall for me, just real life doesn't make a story.
It makes a story for me when the actors have charisma, when they're good actors, because I love what happens in the Before trilogy.
And I should say the same thing, because I haven't seen the Before trilogy. I'm not going to pass judgment on that. I've seen very little else that does things this way. Maybe I just don't jive with the entire idea, but, you know.
And I think when you're going forward with the intention of, like, just showing life, I think you have to do what the Before trilogy does, which is each of the movies is you know, over the course of a day, or maybe even a couple hours, some of them. You know what I mean? Like, it really dives into this
each
one
of them,
area.
Yeah, just a few hours, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. The third one is like what?
The third one's just an evening. The third one's just an evening.
You're right. But it fills up so much of that with so much character. I like how it just dives into that one area. Mm-hmm. And you know.
I don't think this movie's as good as the Before trilogy, but that's also because the Before trilogy I kind of count as one movie, and it's definitely in my top 10 all time. So like.
It's a fucking masterpiece. But in terms of this movie being filmed without like a specific script in mind, obviously I think that's the only way you're able to film a 12-year movie. Like the Before trilogy, I think if you're making a movie of this length of time, it's got to be a collaborative process between you, your actors, as they grow up, how they feel their character changes. Like that's a natural part of it. And there have been plenty of good movies that have been filmed without necessarily a script in place from the beginning. In the Mood for Love, Wong Kar-wai,
Alien 3.
I was going to bring that up, actually.
That's the same to me.
Great example. But also, in The Mood for Love, Wong Kar-wai's great movie. Like they
I need to watch that.
It's good. They just filmed the movie and wrote the script as they shot, because it was this really cool collaborative process. So I feel like it also hinges on that. So I feel like there were just a lot of these behind-the-scenes elements that just didn't quite mesh together. Yeah, but if no one else has anything to say, unless you guys
Brendan
do.
Did.
I just wanted to say, yeah, I feel like there's this really pervasive theme in a lot of film that, like, real life is as fantastical as anything that you can cook up in a script. And I feel like this movie just takes that too literally, because in trying to show us, like, oh, look, everyday life, but snippets that don't really matter... Isn't this as good as watching Lord of the Rings or Star Wars? Like, no. And I feel like that's something that...
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. We need to confront that and be honest with ourselves that real life sucks sometimes, you know? Like,
yeah, and that's exhilarating to watch it suck on screen.
Why? But, like, not in the moments that it doesn't matter. And that's, like, I feel like that's my big problem with this, is that, like, it's not interesting. And, we don't see the scenes that are actually important to these people. And it's just not well done.
I think
it's not necessarily true.
I think it is.
I think we talk a lot on this show about the kinds of things that film can do. You know, what can film do that
other mediums can't?
Hold on, my computer is frozen, but I'm going to pick up right after that. Oh, my mouse can move, but my Audacity and my Zoom totally frozen.
Well, unlike last time, I made sure that this call what the mic I'm using for this call is my Snowball, so that it's a better quality.
I'm good.
Oh, it's a not Snowball.
Okay. Yeah, wait. So you just said, yeah.
You said what film can do that other mediums can't. Yeah. You didn't finish that other mediums can't.
But I'm going to, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You're exactly right. That other mediums can't. And I feel like with this film, there's no, for me at least, there's no connecting to the main character, because protagonists have, you know, wants, and they have desires, they have something they want to get to, they have obstacles. There's none of that. I think that, like, there's no connecting, there's no rooting for anyone, there's no hoping, no dreading, like, no laughing and no crying, and just every reason that I could conceivably watch a movie, like, everything film can do, this movie just doesn't do it. Like, it's just a nothing story with nothing characters.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. I mean, again, in terms of things that film can do that no other medium can do, first of all, this movie is literally something that nothing else can do. Showing someone grow up the way it does.
Other than just experiencing life.
And again, that's all I need, honestly, in a movie. Like, there's a reason why, I don't know, why Before Midnight to me is a better movie than Avengers Endgame. Like, there's nothing in that movie. Like, yes, Avengers Endgame made my top 20 of last year. I like Avengers Endgame a lot. I think it's a highly entertaining film. It is, for me, those kind of movies are never going to hit me the same way. And it's not the same, not to say that I don't like fantastical movies. I am wearing a Star Wars shirt. My favorite movie is La La Land. Like, it is, you know, I like fantastical stories, whether they be musicals. It is definitely a fantasy. I mean, they literally dance in the clouds at some point.
But like, I was thinking, like, imagine if they did La La Land, but with, like, elves and, like, dwarves.
I mean, yeah. So pick your own, you know, whatever. I love The Shining, which is a horror movie. But, what I love about The Shining, I mean, it gets at real things. And that's what I'm getting at, is, like, whenever a movie is actually getting at something real, like, La La Land is getting at the heart of a relationship that it is very intense, but just because of circumstances doesn't work out. Spoilers for La La Land if you haven't seen it somehow. Or The Shining is like the fear of losing yourself, but also the fear from Danny's perspective of a parent that you don't understand and can't control, or is controlling to you. Those kind of things. Do the Right Thing is a fantastic film. Do the Right Thing feels very similar to this in a lot of ways. In that it is just showing moments and is not passing judgment on the characters for these moments. Another great movie, Do the Right Thing. But I think what you're saying, Logan, I strongly want to push back against. I want to make it clear that I strongly disagree with you that that movies have to have stories, because I think that is very what's the word I'm looking for?
Detrimental?
Defeatist. There we go. I think that's a very defeatist mindset to have, because movies can be so much more than that. They don't have to be a story. I mean, yes, the movies that are popular are movies with stories, with a three-act structure, that have scenes, that have very specific moments. And this, what this movie is doing is it's saying that you don't need that to be connected to someone on the screen. You can show these little moments. And again, for me, maybe it is just that I've had so many of the same scenes play out in my own life, and that I think of life the same way that that Linklater seems to with this movie and the Before trilogy. But I think it goes beyond that, because movies aren't dependent on a screenwriter, I think. And that's coming from someone who wants to write. Like, I want to be a screenwriter, honestly. And I'm saying that there are fantastic movies. I mean, almost every movie is fantastically written by someone, you know, and put down on a piece of paper before that. But to me, I mean, there's fantastic documentaries that you are just sitting there with someone, just taking in their life. And that is always, for me, taking in someone's life is always going to be one of the most exhilarating things that film can do. It is amazing to see the Death Star blow up, but it is also amazing to see the kids of a divorce hiding in their room while their parents yell downstairs. It is just a different emotion that you are getting at. And I think that's what this movie does so well. It shows the big moments, honestly. I think what I'm actually finally starting to understand with what I'm trying to say, it shows the big moments. It shows the moments that, at least for me, that I remember. Like, I think I could tell you the first time I drank, but I actually don't know if that's actually the first time that I drank.
Because you're underage.
I'm not underage, actually. No, I'm not underage.
That's right.
You should remember, man. It's like you turned 18. You turned 21.
Yeah, I turned 21 like a couple months ago.
That's right.
But no, like I could tell you maybe these milestone things. But again, the moments that come back to me more aren't those milestones. Like my high school graduation. Yeah, I walked down a stage. I picked up a diploma and I walked into the other room. I remember that night better when I had to drive through a flood to get home when it flash flooded driving home from the restaurant that I was eating dinner at with my family. Like,
remember when I threw a large soda into the back of a truck at the McDonald's when we graduated?
I wasn't there for that. I was probably at the restaurant.
Yeah,
but speaking of that, I had two other moments that I just really wanted to point out. One, the kid working at the restaurant. I've worked at a restaurant for 5 years. That felt very real. All of that interaction.
That's probably the best scene in the thing.
It's a great scene. I mean, minus the fact, because I hate it when he's like, oh, she didn't touch it, and starts eating the shrimp. I'm like, I would never do that.
Oh, you meant that. I thought the guy who worked on their house and later.
Yeah. No,
oh, my God. I need to talk
cheesy.
About that scene. I
that
have thoughts
cheesy.
On that damn scene.
I didn't quite
that. White savory.
I hate that scene with a passion. But hold on.
No, I didn't need it. But that moment
it's the only time anyone changes.
Wow, that's just so... Dude, Ethan Hawke's character completely changes.
Okay.
Patricia Arquette's character changes quite a bit, but stays the same in some way. Ella Coltrane completely changes. Everyone changes in this movie. But, no, that scene with the restaurant is very impactful. And then to have a speech at his graduation party was very impactful to have the manager there and talk. But another scene that felt very real was the moment in the red room, or the red light room, whatever.
The red light room.
Talking to the teacher.
The dark room.
I think the dark room. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
I think that was one of the most impactful scenes, because I feel like I've had a lot of those conversations here at college at film school with different mentors, and it feels very much like, you know, like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing with your life? Why aren't you doing these other things? And it's just like, okay, I understand what your perspective that you're coming from, but I see it, you know, I just got to live my life. And those are the moments that felt so real. And I mean, the movie was vastly populated by them.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I do agree with what you were saying about critiquing what Logan was saying. Patterson was my number three movie of the decade.
Yeah. Great
Patterson
movie.
I'm filming Adam Driver driving a bus. But for me, what differentiates Tree of Life and Patterson from this movie, even though they're all very naturalistic, you know, I just want to show you life type of films, those two films have a point, or at least give you some avenues to be like, all right, I want you to hook onto this and think about this. With Patterson, it was finding the poetry in everyday life, finding the poetry in friends, these connections. As Patterson writes his poetry, as he pulls it from his dreams, that's what invested me in that movie. And then similarly in Tree of Life, it was finding the magic, finding God in those everyday images. And for me, that's just not here in this movie. But I think we can move on from the discussion we've had.
Yeah,
there,
I want to clarify. I wasn't saying that every movie has to have, big explosions in space or even like a three-act structure at all. But just like
I was,
like you were saying, Matt. Like, even if it's a slice of life thing, it's got to have a point. You know, there's a point to everything, even if it's not, you know, a concrete story. There's a point
Doesn't
at the end of it.
Feel
and when
like
I get
that
to the
point
end,
to you?
When I get to the end, it totally leaves my mind. I only remembered it because I have to talk about it on a podcast.
Look, if I don't watch something explode in a movie, was it even worth watching?
Was it even
If I didn't bad? See an explosion, a boob,
a death,
penis,
a fish peen,
a death,
a brutal murder,
it's just not worth it.
Not yes. worth it.
Yeah.
If I don't watch the Zodiac Killer shoot someone in the face, was it even worth watching?
But yeah, no.
Why was I even here?
I can appreciate like, it doesn't have to be, you know, whatever, these big moments. I get that there are small moments that are also important, but at the end, there should be a point. I didn't feel like there was. Maybe some people get a point out of it. I did not.
Yeah.
But I wanted to...
The point is showing a life. That was the goal of the movie. And again, what I said in the Tree of Life is like coming at a movie from where the director's coming from. That was where Linklater was coming from.
Yeah.
He wants to show a life.
Yeah.
That was the point.
And I get that that's what he was trying to do. I just don't think that makes for a very compelling film. So that's...
That's fair.
I'm seeing where he's coming from, but I'm just not gelling with that. It doesn't really make too much sense to me as an idea for a film. It's a great tagline. 12 years in the making. Very cool.
Good tagline.
Doesn't really work. We talked about this about 50 minutes ago, and then I said, and then we're going to get right back to it. But the music.
Yes.
A couple weeks ago, we were talking about the score in The Tree of Life, done wonderfully by Alexandre Desplat. Same thing in The Shape of Water. And I was like, wow, 2 weeks in a row. And I, just for fun, I looked up, I wanted to look up who did the Boyhood score. I was like, I don't think that it was Desplat because I can't imagine him, like, I feel like I would have remembered that if he had. There's no score. Yeah. Just kind of songs from the era, and it feels so empty. We've talked a lot about, like, especially with Fincher, the effect that a score can have, even if it's just subconscious. But, like, you use the same thing over and over in the game, it feels monolithic, it feels static, you get bored. You use entirely unrelated, disconnected tracks in Fight Club, then the film feels disconnected and it feels a little disjointed. If you use nothing at all, other than, like, some of the greatest hits from 2000s that, like, play on diegetic radios, it's going to feel just incredibly empty. There's nothing to tie it together. There's no, like with The Shape of Water, I was like, you know, extremely negative on that, obviously. You guys can go back and listen to that review. But it still has a distinctive sound. And when I think of The Shape of Water, that's the first thing that I remember. I remember the sound. I remember how cool and inventive that is. There's nothing like that for this. Like...
Oh, for me, it's Hero.
Is that a song in this?
Yeah. The song Hero.
By who?
At the end of the film. Let me look up who it's by. It's when he's driving to college.
Okay, but that's it's one song, and it's one moment that happens at the end. It's no...
Sure.
Yeah.
It's Hero by Family of the Year.
Okay.
This is what I'll say about it. I respect the choice not to have a score, and I completely understand why he did that. I think that's a really ballsy move. That's saying, okay, I want this film to rest on life. I want this to rest on... I want the actors to carry this. I want these scenes to carry that.
The whole point of the movie would feel off if there was a score.
I think it would feel too exploitative or too emotionally manipulative if it was like, okay, insert sad song here. You know, so I respect that. You know, there are plenty of movies that do that. You know, Florida Project, you know, we're just going to show kids, we're going to show a sad moment, and we're not going to necessarily play music over it. I respect that.
Does the Before trilogy have a score?
I don't think
it does.
I think it's really just street noises, right? Like city sounds, you know, and clubs that go into music there.
I don't think there's really music in that movie.
Yeah, so, like I'm saying, I respect that. But I think that if you don't do that, and if you're just going to say, okay, we're going to play music that will obviously, you know, kind of evoke memories from the audience, this nostalgic music for people, I think you got to play it more often, and you got to have your actors or the storyline interact with this music in impactful ways. The music in this movie is all music I listen to outside, like on my own. I love Yola Tango. I love Wilco. I love Tweety. I love Phoenix. Like, this is my shit. I have, like, their records behind me. I love this stuff. But from the beginning of the movie, when they just play Yellow by Coldplay for 10 seconds and then fade it out quick, it's like, I would have maybe appreciated some more. Also, I just don't like that because Yellow is... Like, Yellow's an amazing song, but it's just, like, the most emotionally manipulative song you could have picked. Like, you could have just done, like, something else. I just wish they would have had, you know, in Tree of Life, Brad Pitt's character would play that beautiful concert song on the organ that kind of represented, this repression in the kid's life. And, you know, it kind of latched onto that. And here it was nothing more than, okay, he's driving to school, we'll play the Listomania by Phoenix. So, I mean, for 10 seconds, just to remind audiences, okay, we're in 2009. And I needed something more. I really needed something more. The closest they came was when they played I'll Be Around by Yola Tango when him and the girl were hugging on top of the parking lot. That was the closest they came. I thought that was a good moment because I love that song. I love Yola Tango. But I wanted more of that.
Small point before we get back to the music. Didn't it really feel like there was that 10-minute section where Richard Linklater remade Before Sunrise with the girlfriend at the college?
Yes, and even at the end of the movie, they do the look here, you look away. You know, mm-hmm. They do the thing, which I didn't like, because it's like, you already done that three times. Like, I've seen that. Like, do something coda. Different. I didn't like that, but yeah.
Feels like a coda of the trilogy.
Yeah.
But back to the music, sorry. If there was anything else that you want to say, Logan.
Yeah, well, I did want to mention, Before Sunrise is scored by Fred Firth. Credit where credit is due. Before Sunset, I don't think has one. I couldn't find anything. Before Midnight is Graham Reynolds. Don't know either of them, but I'm sure they're very good.
Yeah.
So it's very minimalistic at the very least.
Honestly, yeah. I think it bookends it. I think at the very beginning of Before Sunrise with a classical on the train, okay. the very end of Before Midnight.
I mean, there's so much that you can do with a score. It's just an extra dimension that you can add, and it's just another dimension that's not there for me in this one. It's kind of disappointing.
Yeah, I don't think I needed it. The music worked for me, especially Hero. Like, when that was the moment that I started crying. When the song Hero played as he was driving, like, I don't know what it is about that song, but with that imagery, but it made me cry, and it's a hugely impactful moment. And yeah, I mean, I don't know, these moments late in the film that I kind of want to hit on, I think were fantastic. Like the remake of Before Sunrise is so great in terms of just that time of him and his girlfriend at the college is fantastic. And I love the way it smash cuts basically to them breaking up. It feels very honest and real about what those kind of relationships are like in high school or into early college, where like when you're in your first one or two like very major relationships when you're a teenager, you have these amazing experiences because it's the first time you've ever had them. And then something happens and you break up and it sucks. And then you have you have your heartache conversation with your parents or your friends or whoever that person is for you. And then you keep going with your life and you go to college. Those two scenes were fantastic.
And then, you eat an edible and go to the Grand Canyon and then look at someone.
Dude, that sounds like fun to me. Sounds like fun to me.
But why it's a shitty remake of the Before movies is that in the Before movies, there were two characters and they were playing off each other. It was, oh, you'll say this strong opinion, I'll say this strong opinion. Okay, I understand you there. There was always a dialogue going on. In the scenes between him and his girlfriend, it's this kid droning on about how society is capitalistic and how they're putting chips in people's heads and her going, oh my gosh, that's annoying.
Frogs
gay. You're so nihilistic. And they stay in these paths, specifically the kid. The kid doesn't change in these scenes. That's why these scenes – and also I don't think Sheen is that good of an actress, and neither is the kid when he gets older. There was no meshing going on. It was just, I'm saying this and you're saying this. Boom.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, it's not as good as Before Sunrise. Yeah, I wouldn't say that 10-minute section is nearly as good as Before Sunrise. Yes. But
maybe that's reminiscent, because, but not quality. Yeah.
Yeah, it made me think that. But again, I don't think it's going for the same thing. For me, it Before Sunrise is what you're saying. It's these two people playing off each other. Here, it's obvious that this isn't that kind of connection between the two people. I don't think it's trying to be that connection between the two people, because I mean, there's a Before trilogy and this is 10 minutes of a kid's life in a movie. You know, it's showing that this relationship, yeah, they weren't right for each other. Like, okay, but it still had an amazing moment where they're standing on the top of the parking garage and they hug and kiss. It feels real.
That was a cute moment. I felt something in that moment. I did. Unless Logan, do you have something to say?
Yeah,
I had one more thing to bring up. Talked about the part in the very last thing.
An amazing ending shot.
As I was doing some research for this, I came across an article, and I'm now wishing that I were able to cite my source, but I don't remember. But it talks about a film from 1999. It's like a superhero comedy with Ben Stiller called Mystery Men. It talks about a character called the Sphinx, who always says the Sphinx thinks that he's saying very profound things that, you know, are just kind of, he just switches phrases around. Here are some of my favorites. He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions. When you care what is outside, what is inside cares for you. And this is the best. When you doubt your powers, you give power to your doubt. And literally the ending of this movie, it's so laughable. It says seize the moment. Let the moment seize you. Boom, we're done. He looks at the camera and we're done. Like,
that worked for me.
Well, and also, I just, like, the moments didn't feel natural. The girl was, I didn't think the girl was a good actress. Like, it just, like, everything felt like very, like,
I like the moment. I think it's a very true statement. Whether or not you think it's cliche, it is cliche. I think that it is kind of a true thing. If you kind of constantly go through your life trying to, like, do something, you're never going to actually experience life, whether than it's just washing over you. I think that's a true statement. Whether or not... I think honestly, this last scene's gonna hit you if you're connected to this movie, if you're connected to this character, and it's not going to if you're not. And again, seeing that amazing, landscape and him just sitting there and just kind of smiling, and just kind of like, yeah, you know, maybe I'll only be friends with these people for another 3 months, because that kind of happens when you're a freshman in college. Or maybe you'll be friends with them for the rest of your life. Like, you don't know. But it shows you that he has moved on to a different stage in his life in a very... just it's a very simple way of just him with new people who we had never seen before, like he had never seen before, sitting out on a rock first night of college, just, you know, getting fucked up and smiling and having a good time and just realizing that this is a whole nother phase in your life that you're going into.
Yeah, but other than being in a new place with new people, how is he different? What happens to him? What are we supposed to be drawn to?
I mean, do you feel like you changed completely when you went to college? You had this moment where you could sit there and just show character growth?
No, which is like, why again, I wouldn't make a movie about it. You see what I'm saying?
Well, it's like the problem was like he was a nihilistic dude. He found a roommate who was nihilistic. Like I didn't feel any like change there. You know what I mean? He was like, oh, I found someone who's exactly like me. Now he wants to do the thing that I want to do.
Right.
He was like, how is he changing?
He did a bunch of drugs and just kind of did whatever he want when he was at home. So like then he goes to college and he's got all this new freedom. And then he just does the same thing. And he has this instant connection with this girl. But like we just saw him with his other girlfriend and they seemed very happy. And then it was just kind of over. Which like I'm not knocking it because that's like. That's sort of realistic. But then, like, you know, what are we supposed to believe is different about this time? What's different by the end than the beginning, other than numbers go up? Time go forward.
I think, all the characters change. Eller Coltrane, you can see a difference in his mindset just from the acting, where Eller Coltrane was, like, he was waiting to get out of there. It feels like you can see him breathe a sigh of relief. Like, he's been this nihilistic person this entire time, and now he's just out in nature, just smiling and having a good time with new people. That feels like change to me in very subtle ways, where you don't need a whole sit-down scene. You know what? He was like, you know what? I was an asshole. Sorry. Like, that's just not how life works.
Yeah, but he discovered nature, rediscovered the power of nature. He always loved nature. He loved going with his dad. He loved swimming. And it was like, all right, he's doing something that he already loves with someone that whose personality matches his own. Like, that's what I did. It didn't quite work for me.
In his comfort zone
maybe
still.
I'll give you, in, like, the very last shot, like, kind of that smile, that look of joy that goes on his face. It's like, okay, that's different. But then the movie ends, and it's like, oh, I want a little bit more.
Yeah,
of that.
The point is that it goes on from there, and you don't have to see what goes on from there. He is now moving forward in his life.
And thank God we don't.
If we could talk about one last thing, because we kind of brushed over this, but the scene with the Latino worker, because this is one of the most enraging moments in the movie for me. It makes me literally just yell at the screen. And I hate it because it almost feels like Linklater is hinging a lot of the movie on this. Because, right, all right, we get the scene, Patricia Arquette. Hey, you know, you should go to college. And he's like, oh, like, okay. And then later on, we're in the restaurant. And he comes up, right before he comes up to them, they're having this conversation where the two kids are very lackluster. And his mom is saying, look, you got to take responsibility. You've got to start living your life. Like, what do you guys, are just so complacent. Like, what's going on? The girl was just, like, drinking the last night. They didn't want to eat anything. Like, they were just very, very complacent about everything. And then the man walks up, and oh, this time he can speak perfect English. You know, this time he holds a good job as a waiter. Look at him. He is now, look at this good American citizen now. He's no longer like this terrible construction worker. I hated that about that. I thought that was like just so racist. Yeah. And then he says this thing and is like, hey, look, like you really changed my life. Like that was, I don't know if you didn't realize it, but you changed my life. And then
that's
mom,
a good sentiment. Everything that they put around it is bad.
The mom and the kids kind of exchange this look, and it's like, okay, that's like a good sentiment, but it almost feels like Linklater's hinging the whole movie on that. He's like, yeah, I showed you all this stuff. Why does it matter? Because you can make a difference in people's lives without you knowing about it. Because in these small moments, these little things happen that you don't even realize. And he does it in this terrible scene that feels so damn staged, and I hate the way they portray this Latino guy. It's so bad.
Yeah, truthfully... Yeah. I liked that thematic element of it, and truthfully, I didn't think about the race angle of that, which is something that I definitely need to be more cognizant of when I watch films, but yeah, I see what you're saying there. And yeah, I think this film, you know, placed in, or this theme, placed in other storylines of why does it matter? Because you can affect people in the end, you know? That might be really effective.
Yeah, Palm Springs.
In a better context. Uh-huh.
Another one of my favorite movies, as we've debated already, kind of on here.
No, talk about Palm Springs, Floyd. I swear to God.
I already did.
It's like every podcast.
I know. We just need to review Palm Springs at some point.
We do. Just a random one. In the middle of Fincher.
Yeah. Just be like, you know what? Hold on, Mank. We got another movie to talk about.
Hold on,
we
got Citizen Kane.
Hold on, Citizen Kane. Step we have aside, Palm Springs to Citizen talk about.
Kane. Citizen we Kane, have a, step aside for Andy Samberg.
We have a 90-minute rom-com starring Andy Samberg that we need to talk about.
Is there anything else in Boyhood?
I don't think so. I think we'll go final thoughts and ratings.
That was white savory bullshit.
But no, yeah, I agree real quick. Yeah, I mean, that's a bad scene, and yes, very white savory and not great. Yeah.
Neat. All right, I guess we're going to final flots and ratings. Sure, what to say flots. About this movie? Yeah, I just didn't jive with this movie. It was also the fact that it was 3 fucking hours long. It made me want to bang my head into a wall. I may have enjoyed this movie more if I had watched it on, like, 1.5 speed or something like that and been like, cool, let's just get through all of this shit. There was no... It was such a slog. This movie is just such a slog because there's nothing happening. And, like, any of the points that it's trying to make, it's like, oh, here's a point that I'm maybe making, and then it's abandoned because we shot a year later and I forgot to write the script better so that it reflected that. And it just, like, I don't know, nothing stuck with me. And, like, it's just, it's just not something that I'm going to want to revisit. And I hope that Richard Linklater fucking learned his lesson for Merrily We Roll Along, because I want that to be good. I mean, you know, it's Ben Platt and Beanie Feldstein and that, so hopefully it'll be a little more interesting with these developed performers than hinging the entire movie on one kid who really didn't do anything with his career and just didn't turn out to be, or sorry, their career, and didn't turn out to be much of a performer in the end. And they have a nose ring now, and good for them. But, you know, it's just, I don't know. I can't in good conscience give this movie anything higher than a C, because it's just not an enjoyable experience for me. I don't know, I guess I'll give it a C. Whatever. Very middle of the road.
So much apathy in that.
So much apathy, you know what? In his words.
Yeah, I guess I'll go next. We can leave Matt for last, but...
Yep.
Yeah, overall, like, same as Brendan, it's just nothing. Just kind of a nothing movie. The runtime, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it almost just... It feels like a huge troll by Linklater. Like, ha, gotcha, you thought there was going to be something to care about, something to take away. But no, the script is just directionless, as you can tell. Like, why would you start... writing a project if you don't have anything to say, if you don't have a story to tell? I hope I can enjoy this movie someday when I'm older. I think that it's a possibility that I'll come around and I'll really appreciate the nuances and, you know, the parents' arcs. I'll know what it's like from, you know, with more time and more perspective. But, like, I am that age now a year older than Mason at the end of the movie, and, like, it's just, the connection isn't there for me. It's just, this is not going to stick with me in any way. Floyd, love you, man. I'm glad I'm glad that you can enjoy this. I'm really bummed that we've been on the opposite side 3 straight podcasts.
3 in a row.
Hopefully next week we'll be able to to have a little bit more in common. But yeah.
Hopefully we're all giving A-pluses to Haunted Mansion.
We will be.
I really, like, I'm not going to give this an F, because that would be implying that, like, it affected me in some way. Like, you know, that I have some strong feeling toward it. I'm going to go... I don't even know. Okay, my thought process here is I gave Shape of Water a D+, because of the score and the cinematography. And cinematography doesn't have too much going on, and there was no score, and I think that took away from it. That the performances are good, I don't know. I think I'm going to go with, like, a D.
Yeah. To go off of where you started, the performances in this movie are fantastic top to bottom.
Start with the connection point there.
Yes. I love Eller Coltrane, actually, in this movie. I think he's actually really good. And, you know, the fact that they didn't want to act much after this, that's fine with me. I feel like I saw at some point that they were producing. Maybe I'm attributing that to someone else. But, you know, they were actually decent in The Circle, which is a really bad movie. I remember watching the movie and be like, oh my god, Eller Coltrane's still acting? But that was random.
What a great reality TV show.
What?
The Circle.
The Circle.
The Circle? I don't know what that is.
Oh, go check it out.
It's a bad movie, though.
It's funny.
It's a bad movie. Don't watch The Circle, starring Emma Watson and Tom Hanks.
It hit at a perfect time during quarantine.
Yes.
Ah, I see.
Peak entertainment.
No, yeah. Eller Coltrane's great, but, I mean, the standout performance-wise for me is Ethan Hawke. I think he's fantastic. Patricia Arquette is fantastic. Lorelai Linklater is very good. And, you know, those are the performances that matter, those four. Yeah, for me, it works. Showing these small moments that feel so big in someone's life, in my own life in some way, I think it feels weird reviewing this movie because it almost feels like I'm reviewing my own life in some ways, which is a very weird thing to do. But, yeah, it was deeply moving to me. By the end, it felt like in so many ways I was just watching moments that were real, that Linklater, and to the extent then once Coltrane started really, you know, coming into the creative process, I really felt like I was just watching them reflect someone's life onto the screen, and that's exhilarating and emotionally impactful in ways that other movies just can't. It's not even that they're not as well made or anything like that. It's just literally like you can't do that. Like, I'm looking at, I don't know, Rebecca, great movie, doesn't make me feel the same, even though it is a very emotional movie, especially when, you know, the ending of Rebecca, oof, awesome, fantastic movie. Just, it's not the same. Yeah, I love this movie to death. I just steal Matt's line. I was sitting at work today, had a little bit of a downtime, and I went on Amazon and I saw the Blu-ray for this was $7, and I ordered it immediately because I'm mad at myself that I don't own this. So now I do, but yeah, it's a fantastic movie. It's an A+. The only flaws I have with it are the after school special scene and that kind of racist scene, and you know what? I've given A+ to movies that I don't like individual scenes, and this is a 2-hour and 45-minute, and that's a probably total of 3 minutes in screen time. So you know what? A+.
Yeah, you know, like Logan said, I love that you love this movie, Floyd. You know, obviously, I'm not gonna tell you can't like this movie because your memories with it are like bad or something. I can't discredit your life, but you know, for me, the movie didn't hit when I watched it the first time, didn't hit when I watched it the second, and it hit less when I talked about it. Starting with the positives, I love Ethan Hawke. Ethan Hawke, be my dad. Ethan Hawke.
Yeah, you just want. I texted that to the group chat. You just want to hug him.
I just want to hug the man. I love him. I love him so much. You know, we haven't done a come on the show in a while, but Ethan Hawke, come on the show.
Yes,
come on the show,
please.
It's been a while. You know, I think he's great, even though he does play Jesse for the majority of this movie. You know, I still like it. Patricia Arquette is pretty good. I love, you know, a scene we didn't really talk about, or the portion of his life, Mason's life, we didn't really talk about, is when he's got that terrible douchebag professor dad who you just want to smack. I can't stand him. I think Patricia Arquette is really good in those scenes where she comes back and tells her kids scene. To come with her. I think that's a very effective scene. But overwhelmingly, this movie, you know, like everyone said, just feels a little pointless. It ends and I go, but why? You know, why? Why should I care? You know, you've shown me all this, but why should I care? And I was waiting for the moment when I should care, and it just never came, and it's all because this kid, I don't care about him. You know what I mean? Something that I would have liked to see explored more. This kid's art. You know, we understood that he was a photographer, that you know, it almost seemed like art was maybe a creative avenue for him to explore things kind of in the same vein of his father doing music. A nice little parallel there. But we never saw any of that. All we saw was the kid just being complacent and being like, eh, you know, I like art, but yeah, it's whatever. And we never got to see any of his art except for a few glimpses of the photographs of Sheena.
Those are good photographs, though.
Sheena doesn't even like them. And it's like, oh, I want to see more of this. It's like, there's some passion here, maybe, but there's none of it.
This is something he cares about. So maybe it's something we'll care about.
They created, like, just a bafflingly boring and complacent character that I just... I don't understand what the choice was to make this kid so annoying. Like, I don't know if they were like, no, the audience will see the charm in between his nihilism. Or if they were like, no, like, he's just going to be nihilistic because it's life and people will understand that it's life. But it's like, you can't just give me an annoying douchebag main character and then ask me to care about him. It's like, I can't do that. I'm sorry. I want to, but I can't. You know, like movies, I love slice of life movies, Patterson, Tree of Life, but I like it when they have some sort of point. Doesn't have to be an explicit point, but it has to be, you know, there's something in here for you to latch onto. Even though, you know, this movie feels relatable at times, there are moments that I relate to. Overwhelmingly, most of the scenes feel staged to me. You know, he was going for this very, like, documentary-esque feel, and it just didn't capture that at all. Would have loved to see the movie interact with music a little bit better. Would have loved to see the characters maybe talk about the music more. Like, how has this impacted them? You know, like, a lot of these songs have impacted me. Listomania? Oh my god. Yola Tango? All the time. The movie ends with, the fucking Arcade Fire song from The Suburbs. One of my favorite albums of all time. It's like, I want more of this. Like, Linklater, we share the same taste in music. I want, like, give me some substance here. But, you know, it's just not one that hits for me. And, you know, I think it's tricky. I'm gonna go with a D+ on this one. You know, because I do respect the acting, and for a portion there in the middle, I do enjoy it. And I think that's probably, you know, the portion with the terrible dad, the professor. I think those scenes are effective, and all the acting there is good. And you know, there's some individual moments I like with Ethan Hawke. So those are the positives, but overwhelmingly just. Not the movie for me. And hopefully Linklater's other experimenting with time movie turns out better. I hope so.
We'll find out in 30 years.
How far into shooting that are they? Because he's 60.
Jesus.
My thought process is like, that's ballsy. You're betting that you're going to be making movies into your late 80s.
He's rolling the dice with that one. I'm excited too, you know, because the Before trilogy, I didn't get to experience that as they came out. I'm like, you know, I'm excited to see, you know, movies as they come out over a long period of time.
Well, it's so, one movie.
The Boyhood fucking thing. Oh, I thought they were doing.
Yeah,
like,
no, it's a musical, but like it takes over. You know, I think it's a stage. It is a stage musical, right, Brendan?
Yep. Merrily, yeah.
That's gonna be weird because, like, with actors, like, with like singers' voices changing and everything. I wonder how they're gonna. With that. What
I
if
mean,
like
that's
someone
how it happens in life.
That's
how it's like. What if someone like starts off being a like with Mason, the actor who plays Mason. What if someone starts out being a good actor as a kid and ends up being a really terrible actor when they're older? What if you equate that to singing? It's like, what's going
to
happen?
I'd be more worried about death. I'd be more worried about death than having to recast 15 years into the movie or having to have Linklater die like 20 years into making it.
We can talk more about Merrily We Roll Along and the context of that as a Sondheim show off mic.
Sure. But yeah, Brendan, what are we talking about next week?
I'm so glad you asked, because we are ending this round of picks with my pick, which of course is 2003's masterpiece, The Haunted Mansion, starring Eddie Murphy. The perfect film, I might say. This was an adaptation of The Ride from Disney World. I definitely saw this movie, like, right when it came out on DVD, because, like, a friend's neighbor had it, and they're, like... All of our I remember it, seeing it for the first time vividly. All of our parents were like upstairs drinking, and all of the kids were in the basement watching The Haunted Mansion. Wonderful night. But if you know me, I'm a huge Disney nerd. I love the Disney parks. The Haunted Mansion is my favorite ride in any of the Disney parks. And I just, you know, like, I watch this movie all the time now that it's, like, available on Disney Plus and everything, and I just love it so much.
I enjoy this movie 10 to 12 times a day.
I enjoy this movie 10 to 12 times a day. But I'm super excited to introduce you guys to The Haunted Mansion.
I've seen it before. Oh, okay. I've seen it when I was a kid.
I have not.
I mean, it's been probably 15 years. I was probably 6 or 7 years old. Good reference.
I'm excited to watch it. I'm excited to look at something fun and, you know, have a maybe a discussion akin
to Cats.
Laughs.
I'm going to bring my A.
Before we get back to the Fincher series and go back to Bleak Nihilism and Wrinkly Babies.
But until we get to those...
Fuck.
But until we get to the rest of those Fincher movies, there are some other shows that you can check out on this very feed. If you liked this episode or if you like, you know, hearing about movies at all, you can check out the CTP Movie Journal. That's Matt and Ryan's miscellaneous short-form movie podcast. And that features...
Which we need to do more of.
You should do more of that.
I'm down to just film random shit.
Features the best of lists. We also have Stop Wait What, our improv comedy advice show, and Back in Style, our newcomer-friendly episodic review of Twin Peaks. Those will be on alternating Fridays. Some other Wednesday shows that we might not be doing every week from here on out.
They might not be released on Wednesdays.
We're just kind of categorizing these shows.
Yeah,
Twisted Mud Mysteries, your one-stop shop for everything spooky and occult. Octo Island, our extended universe Star Wars podcast series. Not yours, it's ours. I Might Play That, our video game review podcast. And you can also check out our YouTube channel for a bunch of other stuff, miscellaneous stuff.
Oh, hell yes, the YouTube channel. I just put out a video on the YouTube channel recently about the Marvel's Avengers game, which recently came out.
It's very good.
It was awesome.
Thank you. It was good. It was really fun to make because I had just finished. I played through the whole game in like 2 days.
Which you reenacted in the video.
I did. It was great.
Glorious.
Yeah, if you want to see that, go check it out.
Go check it out on our YouTube channel. It was a lot of fun to make.
Yes, absolutely. It's just the Twisted Mug Media Network on YouTube.
Yes, and if you also want to find us on other social media platforms, hit us up on Instagram and Twitter. We are at Twisted Mug Media on both of those platforms. We would love for you to give us a follow. You know, as we like to say, this isn't a podcast. This is a community. So come on down, join the fun, and it's going to be a good time. So if you'd like to email us, it's completely derailed there. If you'd like to email us, you can email us, twistedmugmedia@gmail.com. Fat Stu, if you're still listening,
yes,
we saw that you followed us. If you listened to this 2-hour podcast of Boyhood, tell us what you thought about it.
Shorter than the movie.
This is shorter than the movie, yeah. We sometimes go over the movie, so like we're doing pretty good. One small thing also, plug hit us up on Letterboxd. We have a podcast Letterboxd now where we have Logan's been doing a lot on that.
Yes, thank you, Logan.
Compiling our like ranked lists. Going through and putting each of our grades in a composite grade on the movie. And then I believe we also have links to all of our other letterbox. If not in the description, at least just go to the following section of Cinema Talk Podcast. You can find all of our
If you just search Cinema Talk Podcast on Letterboxd, you will find it. And then in the bio of that page, you can see all our individual Letterboxd accounts. So, yeah, definitely go check it out there. We got some cool stuff going on. I have some cool lists. The other guys have some cool lists personally, and then we've got all our series ranked, you know, by average rating and that sort of thing. A lot of math that goes into this, averaging out
always
grades and such.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can definitely go check that out. Some cool stuff.
We're always reviewing new movies here. We're always watching movies in our free time, whether it be for fun or for class. I know I'm watching a decent amount of movies for classes right now. So yeah, go check us out.
Oh, yeah.
We're always watching movies and talking about them. So. We will be back next week with The Haunted Mansion, Brendan's pick. And until then, listen to the other shows, and thanks for listening to the podcast, guys. See ya. I'm Ryan.
Brendan.
And I'm Matthew.
Talk to you next time.
That was a callback to last week's episode.
A minute.